As a service to our blind and print-impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service now presents... The Indie Week. John Federson with you here, reading this week's issue, which is dated February the 23rd of 2022. And it's a big issue this week, and so we'd better get right to it. And I'll begin with the online IndieWeek.com version, which has more up-to-date issues in some stories, in some issues, in some cases, than the print issue, which had to be printed yesterday. First, judges replace the North Carolina congressional redistricting plans, and the state Supreme Court denies all requests for a stay. A panel of Superior Court judges on Wednesday replaced a new map for North Carolina's congressional districts with their own, while deciding that the state House and Senate plans the legislature adopted last week meet constitutional standards set by the Supreme Court. Republican legislators and all groups challenging their plans asked the Supreme Court to stay that trial court decision, but the Supreme Court denied all those requests. Candidate filing under the revised map starts today. Lawyers for Republican legislators, the defendants in the case, objected to the trial court decision to replace the congressional map, saying the judges overstepped by substituting their judgment for that of the legislature. The three-judge panel appointed three retired state jurists as special masters to help evaluate the legislature's latest redistricting plans. The Republican lawyers said in court papers filed yesterday, the trial court was not tasked to use retired judges and mathematicians to create the most fair map in all the land. Rather, the trial court was tasked by the court to adopt or approve a constitutionally compliant map. By imposing its own congressional plan, the trial court, quote, is likely violating federal law. In a recent radio interview, House Speaker Tim Moore said Republicans were keeping open an option for an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, groups that challenged the first set of redistricting plans last year, the North Carolina League of Conservation Voters, Common Cause, and a group of voters backed by National Redistricting Foundation, wanted one or both of the newest state House and Senate maps thrown out. The Conservation Voters and the Redistricting Foundation said the new state Senate map remains skewed in favor of Republicans and wanted it replaced. Common Cause want both the state House and state Senate plans changed, arguing that Republican legislators should have drawn a House district and Senate district where black voters can elect candidates of their choice. Governor Cooper, a Democrat, criticized the decision allowing the state Senate map to be used, calling that redistricting plan in a statement blatantly unfair and unconstitutional and possibly the worst of the bunch. Republicans represented the congressional maps they approved last week as one that had six Republican districts, four Democratic districts, and four that were competitive. The Superior Court judges wrote in their order Wednesday that the congressional plan did not pass the tests the Supreme Court set out to determine partisan fairness. Redistrict expert Dave Wasserman of the Cook Political Report said on Twitter that the court-ordered congressional plan results in seven Republican districts, six Democratic districts, and one competitive district. In addition to a new Charlotte-area Democratic district, there is a competitive but Democratic-leaning district, which includes half of Wake County. But to get a map that is proportional to the state's lean, the map splits black communities in Charlotte, Winston-Salem, Fayetteville, and Raleigh, Wasserman wrote. Redistricting experts and political scientists testified the Republicans' first set of plans was so skewed that it would allow the GOP to expand its majorities in the legislature and keep them, no matter the changes in the political climate. Under the state's first congressional map, Republicans would likely have won at least 10 of 14 districts. The Supreme Court earlier this month found that the first set of Republican-drawn congressional, state House, and state Senate districts were unconstitutional, pro-GOP partisan gerrymanders that diluted Democratic votes. In redistricting, quote, the majority wrote, the General Assembly must not diminish or dilute on the basis of partisan affiliation any individual's vote. And they ordered the legislature to redraw the plans for election districts and submit them to the panel of three Superior Court judges for review. The legislature's new House plan passed with near unanimous votes last week. No Democrats voted for the revised congressional or state Senate plans. Democrats argued the Republicans used mathematical formulas as a cover for gerrymandered plans, Policy Watch reported. In court documents filed yesterday afternoon, lawyers for the National Redistricting Foundation, and by yesterday I mean Wednesday, lawyers for the National Redistricting Foundation voters and for the League of Conservation voters said the legislature approved another terrible Senate redistricting plan. And there's, the article goes on and on and on, and I think that's all I have time to read of that one, of that particular article for now. Next is Joe Killian of North Carolina Policy Watch. His column, as often has happened, is reprinted now in the at the IndyWeek.com. UNC Chapel Hill trustees' involvement in debate between candidates for student body president sparked controversy. Student body president Lamar Richards sent a complaint to the UNC president and chair of the UNC Board of Governors University Governance Committee, alleging that trustee Marty Kotis attended an online debate, asked questions, and offered, quote, pointed, professionally inappropriate responses in the chat regarding answers provided by the candidates. The student body president is calling for the removal of a member of the Board of Trustees. And in an interview with Policy Watch this week, Kotis denied doing or saying anything inappropriate. There is no policy or directive preventing board members from attending student government debates or asking questions, he said. However, Board of Trustee Chairman David Boliak recently advised the board to stay out of student government campaigns and elections. Richards, who as student body president also serves as a member of the Board of Trustees, said Kotis' presence and questions prevented candidates from debating their peers free of board influence, saying in an interview with Policy Watch, it was meant to be a debate among candidates, not a debate with the members of the Board of Trustees. He doesn't seem to realize that because of his role on the board and the questions he was asking about the board, it changed the tone of the debate and made many people uncomfortable. There is shared governance between the board, the student government, and the faculty. It isn't for board members, myself included, to involve ourselves in these campaigns or debates. Kotis doesn't see it that way. He understands the need for board members to stay out of student government elections, he told Policy Watch. In fact, during his time as a member of the system's Board of Governors, he was the driving force in the resignation and censure of East Carolina University trustees who attempted to directly involve themselves in student government elections. And he quote, we quote him, that was a very different situation. In that case, they were making promises to students on policy. They were offering to finance campaigns. They were saying incredibly inappropriate things to these students. They were clearly trying to influence the outcome of an election for their own reasons. By contrast, Kotis said he attended the student debate held online on February 7th and asked what he considered respectful questions about an important issue, how student representatives would work effectively with the university's governing board. If that makes them uncomfortable, he said, maybe they shouldn't be running for office. Richards said he wasn't sure how Kotis had the link to the online debate, which Richards said was sent only to students. But Kotis registered for the event under his own name and virtually raised his hand to ask the first question about candidates' views on working with the governing board. That seems like a softball question to me. They're going to have to be on the board and work with us, and I think it would be interesting for them to say how they'll do that. Later, near the end of the debate, Kotis took issue with candidate Sam Robinson's characterizations of the Board of Trustees as highly partisan and lacking political diversity. Kotis submitted a question challenging that characterization and asking Robinson to elaborate, according to screenshots of the exchange reviewed by Policy Watch. The moderator said they did not believe there was time for the question, so Kotis posted it in the public chat for the online event. He posted, question for Sam. He mentioned a lack of political diversity in leadership on the BOT. given that the chair of the BOT and secretary are both Democrats, and the vice chair is a Republican, all of whom were elected by the full board, can he elaborate on that assertion? In the complaint filed by Richards, the last line of COTUS question was reported as, can he elaborate on that incorrect assertion? That's a misquote, COTUS said. His intention was not to enter into a debate about the veracity of the answer, but to ask him to back up an assertion. He said, if I make an assertion about something, I try to be sure I can back it up. He answered by saying something about how the Republican majority of the General Assembly appoints the members of the BOG and the BOT, and so they're all Republican choices. But I thought it was a polite and respectful exchange. No one seemed to have any problem with it. If anyone had told him it was inappropriate for him to ask questions or attend the debate, he would have accepted that, COTUS said. But it wasn't until later, after COTUS said Richard received complaints from other students, that Richard broached these points. Richards told Policy Watch he was uncomfortable in the moment, but felt it was inappropriate to insert himself into the debate. When he received complaints from students, he said he realized he needed to address them. He did so first by texting and then having a phone call with COTUS, he said. And he said the call didn't get them any closer to resolving the dispute. COTUS didn't seem to understand the inherent power imbalance in play when a member of the Board of Trustees appears at a student debate to ask questions about how candidates will get along with trustees. There are pre-existing tensions between COTUS and Richards going back to Richards' push to force a Board of Trustees vote on an offer of tenure to the journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. During that very public conflict, COTUS took issue with Richards having said that black students shouldn't come to UNC Chapel Hill, which Richards said continues to suffer from systemic racism it hasn't done nearly enough to address. During that controversy, COTUS said, Richards mischaracterized board positions, ascribed incorrect motives to members, and whipped students and alumni into an unnecessary frenzy when the debate over the issue could have been more simple and respectful. COTUS said, if we want to talk about respectful, you have to look at the things he has said and written and tweeted as student body president and a member of the board. I don't feel like anything I've said compares. COTUS also had criticisms for Teddy Van, the student who ultimately won the presidential election. Richards said of COTUS, we don't have to be friends, that's fine. I represent the student body, and I don't apologize for that. I've always said and done what I needed to do in order to do that. But this isn't about me and him. This is about whether it's appropriate for a member of the board to insert themselves into student elections and student debate. It's not. The chair of our board told us it's not. Policy Watch has reached out to Boliak for comment on the complaint, but has not yet heard back. COTUS said he agrees Boliak warned board members at their January meeting to stay out of student government campaigns. But he said that was prompted by a representative for at least one candidate for student body president, Sage Staley, emailing board members to ask for their support for her candidacy. Boliak says it's not the role of board members to involve themselves that way, COTUS said. But, he argued, asking questions at a debate doesn't rise to the level of supporting or opposing a candidate. The conflict over a student government election is symptomatic of a greater tension, apparent and increasing for years, between political appointees on the governing boards of the university system and its individual campuses and students, faculty, and alumni. It is more than a political tension between appointees who tend to lean more conservative, white, and male than the campuses, universities they represent, and a more diverse and liberal student body and faculty. The conflict is, on one of its several levels, about the proper role of political appointees and the way they seek to involve themselves in various parts of the university. Recent clashes over personnel issues, funding, tenure, and the leadership and academic mission of the universities have made it clear the governing boards wish to be more involved in areas in which they have traditionally been more hands-off or worked in collaboration with other groups and stakeholders at the university level. SCOTUS attending and asking questions at a student debate is a bizarre example of this overreach, said Mimi Chapman, chair of the faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. Quote, you would think that members of the Board of Trustees might have more pressing matters to attend to rather than making students uncomfortable in the midst of a student election. This is a student process. Faculty don't involve themselves in this process. We work with whoever the students choose to elect, in the same way they don't involve ourselves in our election. And no one consults either group on who should be on the Board of Trustees. These are separate groups that share governance and are allowed to choose their own representatives and should be left alone to do so. Chapman has herself been criticized by members of the Board of Trustees and Board of Governors as she pushes back on what she says is an obvious increasing politicization of the universities. SCOTUS has criticized Chapman for suggesting there was a plan by political appointees on the university governing boards to oust Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz, which he said was never the case. Boliak recently penned his own, a strongly worded column published in the News and Observer, in which he rebutted recent criticisms of the board and university leadership. UNC Chapel Hill's board is politically diverse, he said, and devoted to the school's success. He wrote, instead of attacking devoted university funders and servants who hold differing political views, it would be much more productive to suggest positive initiatives that make Carolina better, not tear it down. You can't be for something and against it at the same time. The column elicited some criticism from students, faculty, and even former UNC Chancellor Holden Thorpe, who took to Twitter to share that column and his concern about the suggestions that people can't support UNC Chapel Hill and also have strong criticisms. He wrote, hard to imagine something more chilling than the chair of a university board saying, you can't be for something and against it at the same time. And he wrote, too long, didn't read version. No critical thinking allowed. SCOTUS, having recently transferred from a spot on the UNC system Board of Governors to an appointment at the Board of Trustees of his alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill, said students and faculty need to own up to their part in the conflict and ramped up rhetoric. He said, we're raising a generation of snowflakes that can't possibly deal with any sort of question or criticism. Don't dare challenge me on my opinions or ask about facts. That's horrible. You're just supposed to let me rant and never say anything if I'm wrong. At the same time, SCOTUS said, students feel entitled to use whatever sort of rhetoric they feel necessary without explanation or apology. SCOTUS pointed to Teddy Van, the UNC Chapel Hill student who ultimately won the election for student body president. SCOTUS said, frankly, the student who was elected student body president, the last time I saw her, she had a megaphone in her hand yelling obscenities at the board. He was referring to a student protest at last June's meeting of the Board of Trustees at the height of the tenure controversy of Nicole Hannah-Jones. Van, president of the Black Student Movement at UNC Chapel Hill at the time, participated in a protest in which students were ultimately physically removed from the meeting when they refused to leave for a closed session. Several students alleged that at least one student was punched in the face by an officer as they were ejected. Seeking to remove him as a trustee while encouraging that sort of protest at board meetings is hypocrisy, said SCOTUS. I'd love to have a debate and discussion about this because this is a significant double standard. A candidate that showed up for a Board of Trustees meeting shows up, yells obscenities, screams, and disrupts a meeting. I attend a meeting where I have to submit my information and have to be invited to attend. I have to be called on. I sit quietly until they call me. I don't blurt out anything. I didn't have a megaphone. And somehow I should be removed from the Board of Trustees? As of Wednesday afternoon, there had been no response from the Board of Governors to Richard's complaint against SCOTUS. He said he's preparing his own multi-page response in which he will contrast his own actions with that of student and faculty leaders. I've done nothing wrong, SCOTUS said. But if they want to have this conversation, let's have it. A brief article still online. Orange County, North Carolina Animal Services is running low on dog food for its pet Food Assistance Pantry, consider donating money or pet food to help cash-strapped pet owners today. And NC Animal Services in Orange County announced on Facebook it's looking for these donations, specifically dog food. Their goal is to help supply pet food to Orange County residents who are struggling to cover their financial costs due to loss of income during the COVID pandemic. Community members who want to donate can do so online through Orange County Animal Services Amazon wish list or bring unopened bags of pet food to the shelter. They're located at 1601 Eubanks Road in Chapel Hill. You can bring donations into the shelter during operating hours or leave them on the designated shelves in front of the entrance anytime. According to the Orange County Animal Service website, you must be an Orange County resident to apply for pet food assistance. And, quote, your application does not guarantee assistance. OCAS wants to help as many residents as we can, but pet food will be only distributed to Orange County residents as long as it is available. Now to our print issue. An article from Durham by Jasmine Gallup, Mapping Inequality. On a quiet street in southeast Durham, an old one-story home goes for about $220,000. 2 miles away, near the Forest Hills neighborhood, a similar home was sold in 2019 for nearly triple that, $625,000. Today, it's worth almost $1 million. There's one big difference between these two neighborhoods. On Ridgeway Avenue in the Plum Street area, about 83% of residents are black. On Wilshire Drive in Forest Hills, the majority of owners, 78.5%, are white. Just move a historic four-bedroom home in southeast Durham a couple miles west to a white neighborhood, and all of a sudden, it's worth 96% more. Thomas Berry, professor of architecture at North Carolina State University and director of the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Initiative, says, if you look at our built environment, you can see a lot of disparity when it comes to access to quality housing, access to home ownership, access to locally baked goods and services, access to reliable transportation. When you start to look at that whole picture, you quickly recognize how policy leads to those inequalities, and policies are typically created by the powerful. The long-lasting gap in home value has had a profound effect on black families. Often the most valuable thing a family owns is their home. As a home's value increases over the years, homeowners can use the money they save to send children to college, start a small business, or invest in other money-making opportunities. Without a home, building wealth is much harder. Excess income goes to cover rent hikes or moving expenses. Over the years, it builds up until we get to today, when the typical white family has almost 10 times the wealth of a typical black family, according to the Brookings Institute. Racism alone accounts for a $48,000 difference in home values, according to a 2018 study by Brookings researchers. Stripped of factors like crime rates, school quality, and building age, that's how much an average home in a majority black neighborhood is undervalued compared to an identical home in an identical all-white neighborhood. Statewide, only about 47% of black families own their home, compared to 75% of white families. Redlining. The segregation and divide in home values and ownership that exists in Durham and most other major cities dates back to the 1930s. Following the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal gave millions of Americans the chance to buy a home, building wealth for generations to come. Those opportunities, however, mostly went to white families, as lenders denied loans and federal financial aid to black Americans. The Homeowners Loan Corporation, established in 1933, rated neighborhoods by risk. Green neighborhoods were safe for mortgage lending, and people living there were able to get a loan backed by the federal government. Red neighborhoods, on the other hand, were deemed too risky for loans, and without federal support, banks would not lend to those living there. Maps from the Home Owners Loan Corporation show these ratings boiled down to the racial makeup of a community. Even one black family living in an area could make it a declining neighborhood, in the words of the administrators at the time. Descriptions of these areas are shocking to modern ears. One administrator wrote about the Plum Street, St. Teresa neighborhoods. This was formerly a good white residential street, but Negroes are gradually taking up the area. Today, attitude towards these communities hasn't changed much. Several community ranking websites rank Plum Street as one of the worst neighborhoods in Durham based on crime rate and other factors. The average home value is about $80,000. Residents living below the poverty level now number about 27%. A nearby elementary school, C.C. Spaulding, is the worst performing in the country, Fast food and convenience stores far outnumber grocery stores, increasing food insecurity. There are no homes within a quarter mile of a health clinic or pharmacy. Violent crimes per square mile are 20 times higher than the countywide rate. What many don't realize, though, is that the quality of the neighborhood isn't a reflection on its residents, but on the racist practices dating back decades. More recently, some Republicans, including Senate Leader Phil Berger, have warmed up to the idea, recognizing a need to close the insurance gap in the state. The federal government subsidizes 90% of the cost for adults enrolled through the ACA expansion. The American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 provides additional financial incentive for the 12 states that have yet to approve, allowing them to temporarily draw down additional federal funds. The National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL, estimates North Carolina could get an additional $1.5 billion to $2 billion in federal funding. Kate Blackman, NCSL Health Director, and Emily Blanford, NCSL Program Principal, presented a report to the legislators on Friday with specifics on North Carolina and an overview of what other states have done. Lambeth told Blanford about another hallway conversation he's had, one that many Republicans have echoed as they explained their financial worries about expanding Medicaid. They worry the federal government will shift the fiscal burden to the state by decreasing its percentage of funding either abruptly or over time. Lambeth said, the second part of that financial piece, you know, hallway conversation, is, well, they started at 100%. That rate dropped to 90. What prevents them from going down to 70, 60, or 50 and pull the rug out from under us and put more pressure on our state budget because of all of a sudden now we've done it? It's hard to take away a benefit, and we're just going to have to pay more because, you know, they kind of pulled that rug out from under us on that 90%. What does the law say about the 90%, and how would that percent be changed? The federal government's commitment to providing states with 90% of the expansion cost is written into the Social Security Act, Blanford responded. So it would take an act of Congress to change the law. Lambeth explained after the meeting that he was trying to get answers throughout the 2.5-hour discussion to dispel misinformation he'd heard from legislators who often stopped him in the corridor because they knew he was co-chair of the new committee. Though some long-time critics of expansion have warmed to the idea during the coronavirus pandemic, such as the powerful leader of the Senate, there are still staunch opponents, especially in the state house. Lambeth told reporters after the meeting, we're not lukewarm in the House. It's still rather chilly. It's a heavy lift to convince our House caucus that this is the right direction to go. Now, is it impossible? No. I wouldn't be here if I thought it was impossible. The committee touched on a wide range of health care topics on Friday. The lawmakers discussed how to rein in the surprise medical bills that insured people get after inadvertently receiving care from an out-of-network provider they did not choose. They also discussed the shortage of nurses and other healthcare providers already hampering the state, and how to help struggling rural hospitals and expand care access in those areas. The next meeting of that Medicaid Expansion Committee is set for March the 1st. The pandemic has exposed underfunded healthcare systems and a lack of convenient access to quality care for numerous North Carolinians, many who live in some of the more rural districts represented by Republicans. Lambeth said he expected the committee to spend months fact-finding and creating recommendations for what he called a North Carolina plan that could be ready in August or September and perhaps put to a full General Assembly vote by October. That could be a politically charged vote before the November elections. That plan might expand Medicaid or subsidize coverage to hundreds and thousands of North Carolinians without specifically calling it Medicaid expansion. Lambeth said, I can sort of view this as the health care session. Senator Keith Corbin, Republican, the 50th District, a committee member, is interested in exploring an array of programs that he has heard other states have used, and he says, The view from 130,000 feet is that we have a large number of uninsured people. We need to get those people insured. How to do that is the question. Saying, Medicaid expansion used to be a bad word in some corridors of the legislative building. I think it has been, but I think it's not so much anymore. The cover of the print issue, titled Bigotry Sells, is written by Lee Toss and Jeff West. Last summer, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson stood on a wooden podium behind a red, white, and blue flower garland on the stage at the Asbury Baptist Church in Seagrove. There, he proclaimed that educating children on topics like transgenderism and homosexuality is abuse. Robinson delivered the remarks like a preacher, his booming voice rising to the growing applause to the audience as his hands gesticulated sharply, cutting through the air. He said, there's no reason anybody anywhere in America should be telling my child about transgenderism, homosexuality, any of that filth. And yes, I called it filth, and if you don't like that I called it filth, come see me and I'll explain it to you. While the comments were recorded in June, the outrage didn't come until October, when advocacy group Right Wing Watch tweeted that video. It went viral and the story went national, spurring countless articles and think pieces condemning Robinson's comments and casting yet another humiliating spotlight on North Carolina politics. But as the clicks came in, so did donations to Robinson's campaign committee, Friends of Mark Robinson. Robinson is widely expected to run for governor of North Carolina in 2024. An Indie Week analysis reveals that on October 8th, the day after national outlets picked up the story, Robinson received the largest number of contributions up to that point. Up till then, he averaged 76 donations per day. That day, the number of donations increased sixfold. Fox News aired the story on October 10th, and Robinson pulled in 561 donations on October 13th. He set a fundraising record to the tune of $48,000 the next day. 1/6 of all the donations Robinson received during those last 6 months of 2021 came during those 7 days. Carolina Forward, progressive advocacy group director Blair Reeves says, "Bigotry sells. Mark Robinson is a bigot, full stop. Everyone knows that. He's not something anyone's mistaken about, and he's proud about it." Baiting liberals into outrage has become too common a formula for catapulting right-wing figureheads into the national spotlight. According to Robinson's campaign finance report, his donors include Raleigh developer John Kane and the CEO of Coca-Cola Bottling Company, J. Frank Harrison III. Both gave Robinson the maximum allowed contribution, $5,600. Meanwhile, Larry Barber, president and CEO of North State Bank, donated $2,500. None of those three responded to the Indy's request for comment on the matter. Robinson's team didn't respond to our phone call either. Perhaps not everyone who donated to Robinson that week, the best fundraising week of the entire campaign year, gave money precisely because they heard his filth comment and supported it. But not very many people asked for the money back. Robinson campaign issued reimbursements to just three individuals. They totaled $270. Since July, just 28 people have received refunds. It's unclear whether any requested their money back or donated more than the maximum contribution limit, making Robinson's campaign legally obligated to refund them. Controversy spurring an influx in donations is nothing new, says Democratic campaign strategist Maggie Barlow, who worked on statewide campaigns, including Sherry Beasley's successful run for Chief Justice on the state Supreme Court. Barlow says, "Anything that riles people up to no matter what always helps with grassroots small-dollar donations, and candidates always like to have that kind of support. It gets more people interested in the campaign." But it's a strategy that's ultimately bad for business. Barlow recalled the backlash from the business community following the passage of North Carolina's controversial bathroom bill, House Bill 2. Barlow says, "Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson is attacking North Carolinians who are customers, clients, tourists." Bob Phillips, executive director of Common Cause in North Carolina, an advocacy group fighting for fair elections and campaign finance reform, says, "Robinson's team is not blind to the fact that Lieutenant Governor's penchant for inflammatory comments is a moneymaker." Phillips told Indy, "I think what we're seeing speaks to just the toxic world we are in. It's a game, and for people who respond, the donors, whether they responded right afterward, they know him, they know his views, and to invest, that's something that's fair to question." He continued, "There are some folks who will invest in both sides, and they really don't care about what kind of positions people have and what kind of visions they are espousing. It's a stain on our democracy. Big money politics stinks." Common Cause is one of the plaintiffs in the state's ongoing legal battle over gerrymandering. Phillips says his organization would never advocate for a law that would prevent people from donating to the person of their choosing or punish politicians that engage in hateful rhetoric like Robinson does routinely. Still, the fact that hate speech was an effective financial boom for Robinson, who is notorious for saying asinine things, more about that in a minute, is a discouraging, albeit unsurprising, reality. Quote, the people who fan those flames and the people who respond, they are complicit. And until we can actually push reforms through, this rhetoric is becoming increasingly par for the course. And as a sidebar, an incomplete list of asinine things Mark Robinson has said. There is no reason anybody anywhere should be telling any child about transgenderism, homosexuality, any of that filth. And yes, I called it filth. He said straight people are, quote, superior to gays. He said gay people are, quote, what the cows leave behind, maggots and flies. Saying Senator Raphael Warnock has the wisdom of, quote, a crack-addicted mugger in the final stages of syphilitic insanity. Another quote, so since we're talking about canceling student debt, I've got some parent debt to cancel too, you know, stuff like a mortgage and auto loans. On COVID restrictions, the Constitution restricts the government from illegally quartering soldiers in my house. It doesn't say a thing about how many guests I can have over for Thanksgiving. On past and present presidents, if we still had the mean tweets, we'd probably still have the workers, jobs, and gas. Hashtag job killer Joe. Hashtag no go go juice Joe. Quote, the looming pandemic I'm most worried about is socialism. Democrats booed God. And finally, 2 + 2 doesn't equal transgender. Well, let's talk about food. The 2022 James Beard Awards are heating up as 5 Triangle Chefs and 1 restaurant rise to the semifinals. The Oscars of the food world were put on hold for 2 years. Now they're back and full of North Carolina flavor, writes Sarah Edwards. The announcements of the Foundation Awards winners ended up being chaotic in 2020 for a fundamental reason. Though the shortlist had been announced month before and final decisions made since, no awards were given out. James Beard Foundation CEO wrote, "At an honor which we know is held in high regard at the moment feels minor when compared to the dire situation we are in." In a press release, in fact, that went on, the foundation would also forego awards in 2021, as well as it wrestled with the dire condition of restaurants and workers, the clouds of suspicion cast across many of the high-profile institutions associated with the awards, and the stark lack of diversity in the foundation's list of finalists that year. A pause was in order. 2 years later, with a new list of values and procedures made public by the foundation, the awards are back. I'm going to interject now that the article online where I am now, the list of values and procedures are links, and you can find out what they are by going to those links in the online IndieWeek.com. The long list of semifinalists includes 16 North Carolina restaurants, 6 of which are based in the Triangle. 5 Triangle Chefs are contenders for Best Chef Southeast, and I'll name them in a minute. And here they are. From Oscar Diaz from the Cortez in Raleigh, Sonny Gerhardt, 6 St. Rock Fine Oysters Bar, Raleigh, Chiti Kumar Garland in Raleigh, Ricky Moore from the Saltbox Seafood Joint in Durham, Aaron Vandermark, Panciuto in Hillsborough, Alley 26 also made the list in the Best Bar Program category. For other local restaurateurs, the James Beard Awards are familiar territory. Ricky Moore, chef and owner of Saltbox Seafood, first made it to the Best Chef Southeast semifinal list in 2019 before losing out to Mashama Bailey at The Gray in Savannah, Georgia. Moore said, "It feels good to be recognized always, and I'm super grateful." Moore told the Indy over the phone on Wednesday as he stepped away from the Brazilian fish stew he'd been making. I take everything in stride, and like I said, these things that come are just, you know, feathers in the hat. And all the other candidates who also got nominated, North Carolina's got some good cooks, man. Really good practitioners and chefs who have a reverence for our terroir. G.D. Kumar, chef and co-owner at Garland, is also a veteran of the awards. This year marks her fifth nomination. She was a semifinalist for the Best Chef in America category in 2017, 18, and 19, and a nominee for the category in 2020. And Kumar says, it's always so wonderful to have this happen, but it just feels a little different, you know. It's been so long since we've had anything to celebrate in our industry. I'm at a loss now on how to feel. There's so much recovery, and it feels so difficult. Kumar says over the phone, adding that pushback from customers unhappy with precautions hasn't helped. Still, she adds, though the James Beard Foundation Awards are not accompanied by any pandemic finish lines, it still feels good to celebrate with other local restaurants. She's saying, I'm particularly thrilled to see so many Triangle chefs on that list. I think that makes me happier than ever. Now, on June 13th in Chicago, the James Beard Restaurant and Chef Awards ceremony will be held. And once again, you can see on IndieWeek.com in this article about the James Beard Award, the long list of North Carolina semifinalists and others, including 16 restaurants in the state. Now, an important tradition from Indie Week, formerly the Independent, are the Best of the Triangle. And those nominations are now open, and the nominations close on March the 6th, and they're nominations for businesses mostly and organizations. Best of the Triangle. And online at indieweek.org, you can find an internet nominating procedure. It's been a coveted honor for individuals for the last 22 years. The Indie Week Star Decal is the most recognizable sign of a great business within the Triangle, because it demonstrates the dedicated love of business earned throughout the year from folks like you. After the period ends, a final vote for the top nominees will begin in April. And on the June 15th print edition of Indie Week, the Best of winners will be announced. And the article goes on to tell you how to nominate. Please write in a nomination to show your support for your favorite local businesses. Please only make one nomination per category. This means one vote per person. Don't vote from multiple email addresses. Once nominations close, the top four with the most nominations in each category will advance to a final ballot. An email will be needed for registration to ensure ballot integrity. And Indy reserves the right to reject any ballot that appears to violate the spirit of Best of the Triangle. And says, want to promote your business? The final ballot receives over 500,000 votes from readers. For promotional opportunities on that ballot, please take a moment. They've got an informational video. Contact sales at IndieWeek.com to confirm your ad spot, as space is limited. And that's it from the online issue, and I will return now to the print. All right, let's move back to print edition, as I said, from music to local releases by Quetico and a group we should know, Superchunk. They inspire long drives, write Brian Howe and Jordan Lawrence. Brian Howe writing the first review of Quetico, giving it 4 stars, released February 8th, the 2nd, by himself. Quetico, Know You Are is the reason of the title of this album. For most families, producing one tall, lanky drummer with polyrhythms in his hands and a sort of cosmic irony in his eyes would be plenty. But the facts show that the Westerlunds of Wisconsin have issued at least 2. Brothers Joe and Jan Westerlund, Joe from Megafun and Mandolin Orange, and Jan from Canine Heart Sounds and Bowerbirds, who once shared what must have been a very rackety room, have thoroughly infiltrated the Triangle's indie bands over the last 13 years. They've also both emerged and diverged as composer bandleaders. Joe's music feels ancient, mystical, and fluid, whereas Jan's, as Quetico, is retro, worldly, and perchly shaped. His first album, Man Alone, was mostly a solo project that established Quetico's eccentric crossroads of elaborately metered jazz, pitter-pattering techno, and glossy pop finishing. But on his new record, Know You Are, Jan is joined by Tim Sullivan and the Bowerbirds' Mark Paulson, among others, suffusing his percussion and electronic pads with fragrant woodwinds and synths. The songs are lush but run so clear that their challenging time signatures often hardly even registered. They're more special sauce than the main course, this time. If You Know You Are can be said to be any one thing, it's a voyage through the grooviest, most sensuous parts of throwback FM radio. There are strains of symphonic 1970s soul, especially on the outstanding Putnam Heights, svelte 80s R&B, and progressive soft rock. Canine Heart Sound's Worship Team is reworked as gospel-tinged electropop. Awanas makes minimalist sax ostinatos swoon. Sade would crush Keith. The melodies form a bright, engaging carapace over the intricate gear work, and there is much you would linger on if it came up in a weekend block on Foxy 107, the lunchtime jazz program on WNCU 90.7, or the bridge of a Toto song on G105. Brian Howe gives Know You Are by Quetico 4 stars. And from Jordan Lawrence, Superchunks, release on February 25th, Wild Loneliness. And Lawrence writes, I keep hopping in my car to listen to Wild Loneliness. It's an odd reaction to what is an unusually restrained record for Superchunk. The Chapel Hill indie rock luminaries open and close with lush and thoughtful ballads. Each song is girded by acoustic rhythm guitar, skewing closer to the pop end of the pop-punk spectrum. It's more nervy, cutting, and quintessentially Superchunk records, like 1991's endlessly propulsive On the Mouth, or 2018's righteously pissed off What a Time to Be Alive, are more obvious pairings for rolled-down windows and open roads, but like that last, most recent Superchunk album, which responded with brutally entertaining venom to, quote, the scum, the shame, the effing lies of Donald Trump's presidency, Wild Loneliness is supremely suited for its moment. The new outing seeks both connection and release as it takes stock of a world that feels increasingly isolating and despondent. The band responds with songs that find hope in reaching out, carried by arrangements that are airy and reassuring, but still plenty impellent. They make me want to get out and drive to go do things again. Recording separately during the pandemic, Superchunk smartly used that as an opportunity to bring in remote talent to contribute. The additions are beautiful, but off-kilter, enhancing the album's pursuit of balance in an unbalanced time. Enchanting saxophone shimmers from Y-Oak's Andy Stack layer at attractively odd angles atop the steady jangle of that title track. It's a nice fit for a song written mid-pandemic that reflects upon the unease of seclusion. Take a lap, take a hike, Mac McGowan sings. Shake the spiders loose any way you like. Kelly Pratt from David Byrne or Beirut adds giddy horns to the acoustic rock tumble of Highly Suspect. It's a fine mirror for McCowan's narrator, who hides his feelings and becomes disconnected. You've been highly suspect of my cheerful affect, and you were right. It's a construct. Owen Pallett's Gauzy Strings bring an appropriately scrappy nobility to City of the Dead, where, despite Halloween floods and wild winds whipping, Mac McGowan declares, "But I'll still make the coffee, and we still make the beds, and the kids are scarred but smarter." The variety of additional vocalists, Sharon Van Etten, Teenage Fan Club's Norman Blake, and Raymond McGinley, REM's Mike Mills, Camera Obscura's Tracy Ann Campbell, don't make as distinct an impact, but do provide cathartic camaraderie. Some of the best songs are elevated by Superchunk's excellent chemistry, despite the distance recording. John Worcester and Laura Balance's lithe and commanding rhythms bring certainty to offset McGaughan's clever, self-deprecating on climate change alarm bells. "Endless summer, I'm a broken record. I'm a year-round bummer, but I'm not ready for an endless summer." On the closing, "If You're Not Dark," Jim Wilbur weaves guitar lines that balance arena-sized melancholy and wiry anxiety as McGaughan rises patiently from fragility to certainty, building to a chorus ready-made for 2022 and life in general. "If you're not dark, at least in some little part, what are you on? And can we get some?" And Jordan Loris finishes by saying Superchunk has never been better, or better for its time. And he awards that Wild Loneliness album by Superchunk 4 stars. Now, also from the print edition of the Indie Week, takes a look at dance impresario Chuck Davis from the African American Dance Ensemble, who was located in Durham and died in 2017, and Andre Leon Talley, who had been the creative director of Vogue magazine, the first African American to serve as that, who just died at the age of 73 last month. And it's a long juxtaposition of the two lives, who may or may not actually have ever met, but they all had a lot in common, and it discusses them. Tomasi McDonald wrote that. Unfortunately, there's no time for us to play that today. Now I have to close, and this issue will be available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. And this is recorded on Thursday, the 24th of February, right on the morning of Russia's invasion the Ukraine. So lots going on in the news realm, but we'll be back next week with perhaps some articles on that subject too. John Feddersen saying so long from Indie Week.